Chasseur flew down alone from the Witwatersrand in the Rapide and landed at Young's Field after dark. He drove directly from the airfield to Blaine's home in Newlands Avenue. Tara opened the door to him, her face lighting when she realized it was him. "Oh, darling, I missed you." They kissed rapturously until Blaine's voice made them start apart. "Look here, Chasseur, I don't like to interrupt anything important, but when you can spare a moment, I'd like to hear your report." Tara was blushing furiously. "Daddy, you were spying on us." "Public display, my dear, no spying necessary. Come along, Chasseur." He led the way to his study and waved Chasseur to a chair. "Drink?" "I'd like a ginger ale, sir." "How are the mighty fallen?" Blaine poured a little of his hoarded whisky for himself and handed Chasseur the ginger ale. "Now, what is it that you couldn't talk about on the telephone?" "We just might have a bit of luck at last, sir." On Blaine's orders, Chasseur had flown up to Johannesburg as soon as the Fordsburg bank robbery had been linked to the Osewa Brandvag. He had been at Marshall Square, the headquarters of the CID, while the captured bank robber was being interrogated. "As you know," he said, "the fellow is an official on the crime mines. Thijs Lorenz is his name, and sure enough, he was on our list of known OB members. Not one of the big fish, however, but quite a formidable-looking chap, although I'd expect him to be a bit of a boozer. I told the police inspector that you wanted answers." "No rough stuff," Blaine frowned. "No, sir, it wasn't necessary," said Chasseur. "Lawrence wasn't as tough as he looked. We only had to point out that the penalty for armed robbery and accessory to murder was the gallows, but that we were prepared to do a deal," and he started to gush. "I gave you most of what he told us when I telephoned you this morning." "Yes," said Blaine, "go on." "Then he gave us the names of the other men involved in the robbery, that is, three of them. We were able to make the arrests before I left Johannesburg. However, the leader of the gang was a man he had only met 3 days before the robbery. He did not know his name or where we could find him."
"Did he give you a description?" asked Blaine.
"Yes, sir. Big man, black hair and beard, crooked nose, scar over one eye. A pretty detailed description, but he gave us something else which may be vital."
"What is that?"
"A code name," said Chasseur. "The leader is known only as De Witsford, the White Sword, and they were ordered to cooperate with him from the very top level of the Sturmjägers."
"White Sword," Blaine mused. "Sounds like something out of Boy's Own Paper."
"Unfortunately, not so childish," Chasseur went on. "I impressed upon the inspector in charge that the code name and the description must be withheld until he had orders from you personally."
"Good." Blaine sipped his drink, pleased that his trust in Chasseur Courtney had been so soon vindicated. "White Sword. I wonder if this is the trigger we have been looking for, the catalyst that has at last brought the OB to the point of action."
"It could very well be, sir," said Chasseur. "All the arrested members of the gang are obviously very much in awe of the man. He was clearly the force behind the entire thing, and he has disappeared completely. There is no trace of the missing money. Incidentally, we have established that it is over £127,000.
"A tidy sum," Blaine murmured. "And we must presume that it has gone into the war chest of the OB, probably along with the gelignite from the railway hijacking.
As far as this code name goes, sir," said Chasseur, "I would like to suggest that we continue to keep it from the press and everybody not directly concerned with the investigation."
"I agree," said Blaine. "However, let me hear your reasons. See if they are the same as mine."
"Well, firstly, we don't want to alert the quarry. We don't want him to know that we are on his track."
Blaine nodded. "Quite so."
"The other reason
is that it will confirm the reliability of any informant who uses the code name.
I don't follow you, Blaine frowned.
Your appeal to the public for assistance has resulted in a flood of telephone calls, but unfortunately most of them are bogus. If we let the code name become general knowledge, they'll all be using it.
I see.
Use of the code name will establish the caller's credentials, said Blaine.
That's it, sir.
All right, then. We'll keep it under the hat for the time being. Is there anything else?
Not at present, said Chasser.
Then let me tell you what has happened here while you were away. I have met the Prime Minister, and we have decided to declare the OB a political organization. All civil servants, including the police and the army, will be obliged to resign their membership immediately.
Well, that won't alter their sympathies, Chasser pointed out.
Of course not, Blaine agreed. We will still have something like 40% or 50% of the country against us and for Nazi Germany.
It can't go on like this, sir.
You and the UBAS will have to force a showdown, said Chasser.
Yes, we know that.
As soon as our investigations are complete, as soon as we have a pretty comprehensive list of the ringleaders, we will swoop.
Arrest them?
Chasser was startled.
Yes.
They will be interned for the duration of the war as enemies of the state.
Chasser whistled softly.
Pretty drastic, sir.
That could lead to real trouble.
That is why we have to scoop them all up in the net at one time. We cannot afford to miss any of them.
Blaine stood up.
I can see you are exhausted, Chasser, and I am sure there are a few things that Mademoiselle Tara has to say to you. I'll expect you at my office at 8:30 sharp tomorrow morning.
They moved to the study door,
and Blaine added as an afterthought, By the way, your grandfather, Sir Gary, arrived at Veltevreden this morning.
He has come down for his birthday, Chasser smiled. I look forward to seeing him. I hope you and Field Marshal Smuts will be coming to the birthday picnic as usual.
Wouldn't miss it for the world. Blaine opened the study door, and across the lobby, Tara was hovering innocently, pretending to be selecting a book from the shelves in the library. Blaine grinned.
Tara, you let Chasser get some sleep tonight. Do you hear me? I refuse to work with a zombie tomorrow.
The meeting in Blaine's office the following morning lasted longer than either of them expected, and later moved down the passageway to the Prime Minister's office, where Field Marshal Smuts personally questioned Chasser. His questions were so searching that Chasser felt drained by the effort of keeping pace with the UBAS's mercurial mind. He escaped with relief, Smuts's admonition following him.
We want this fellow, White Sword, whoever he is, and we want him before he can do any more damage. Get that message across to everybody involved.
Yes, sir.
And I want those lists on my desk before the weekend. We must have these fellows locked up and out of harm's way.
It was mid-morning before Chasser arrived at CID headquarters and parked the Jaguar in the reserved bay that had been set aside for him. The special operations room had been set up in one of the extensive basement areas. There was a constable on duty at the door, and Chasser signed the register. Entry was restricted to persons on the list. Many of the police force were known OB members or sympathisers. Inspector Lewis Nell had chosen his team with extreme care. He was a balding, taciturn man whose age and job classification had prevented him from volunteering for overseas military service, a fact that he bitterly resented. However, Chasser had soon discovered that he was an easy man to like and respect, though a difficult one to please. They had quickly established a working rapport. Nell was in his shirt sleeves, a cigarette dangling from his lips as he talked into the telephone. but he covered the mouthpiece and summoned Chassa with an imperious wave.
"Where the hell have you been?" "I was going to send out a search party," he reprimanded him. "Sit down, I want to talk with you."
Chassa perched on the corner of his desk while the inspector continued his telephone call, and he stared through the window into the busy operations room. Inspector Nell had been allocated 8 detectives and a bevy of female stenographers. The room was full of cigarette smoke and the clatter of typewriters as they worked. One of the other telephones on the inspector's desk rang, and he glanced up at Chassa.
"Take that," said Nell. "Damn switchboard keeps putting everything through to me."
Chassa picked up the receiver. "Good morning. This is CID headquarters. May I help you?" he said. And when there was silence, he repeated it in Afrikaans.
"Hello. I want to talk to somebody."
The caller was a woman, a young woman, and very agitated. She was speaking Afrikaans, and her voice was breathless and uncertain.
"In the paper, they said you wanted to know about the Oseva Brandvag. I want to talk to somebody."
"My name is Courtney," Chassa said in Afrikaans. "Squadron leader Courtney. I'm grateful that you want to assist the police. You can tell me everything." He tried to make his voice warm and reassuring. He could sense that the woman was afraid, perhaps on the point of changing her mind and ringing off.
"Take your time. I'm here to listen to you," he said.
"Are you the police?"
"Yes, madam. Would you like to give me your name?"
"No, I won't tell you."
He realized his mistake.
"That's perfectly all right," he said. "You don't have to give your name," he told her quickly.
And there was a long silence. He could hear her breathing.
"Take your time," he repeated gently. "Just tell me what you want to."
"They are stealing the guns."
The woman's voice sank to a whisper. "Can you tell me what guns?" Chassa asked carefully.
"From the gun factory in Pretoria, the railway workshop."
Chassa sat up straighter and held the telephone receiver with both hands. Almost all the military arms and munitions manufacture was being undertaken in the railway workshops in Pretoria. It was the only establishment with the heavy equipment, high-speed lathes and steam presses, capable of turning out barrels and blocks for rifles and machine guns. The cartridge cases for the munitions were being stamped out at the Pretoria Mint, but they were dispatched to the railway workshops for final processing.
"What you are saying is important," he told her carefully. "Can you tell me how they are stealing the guns?"
"They are putting scrap iron in the cases and stealing the guns," the woman whispered.
"Can you tell me who is doing this, please? Do you know who is responsible?"
"I don't know the people in the workshop, but the one who is in charge, I know who he is."
"We must know his name," Chassa told her persuasively, but she was silent. He could sense that she was struggling with herself, and that if he pushed her now, he would lose her.
"Do you want to tell me who he is?" he asked. "Just take your time."
"His name..."
The woman hesitated and was silent a moment longer. And then she blurted out,
"They call him Witsford, White Sword."
Chassa felt his skin crawl, as though it were infested with vermin, and his heart seemed to check, miss a beat, and then race away wildly.
"What did you say?"
"White Sword. His name is White Sword," the woman repeated, and there was a crackle and a click as the connection was broken.
"Hello! Hello!"
Chassa shouted into the receiver. "Are you there? Don't hang up!" But the hiss of static on the empty line mocked him. Chassa stood beside Blaine Malcolmus's desk while he made the call to the Commissioner of Police at Marshall Square in Johannesburg. As soon as you have the search warrant, you are to close the workshops, said Blaine. No one allowed to enter or leave. I have already spoken to the military commander of the Transvaal. He and his quartermaster general will give you full cooperation. I want you to begin the search right away, open all the weapons cases in the stores, and check every item against the factory production sheets. I will be flying up, leaving immediately. Please have a police car meet me at Robert Heitz Airfield at, he glanced at Shasta for a time, 5 o'clock this evening. In the meantime, I want you to impress utter secrecy on all your men involved in the search. One other thing, Commissioner. Please select only men who are you satisfied are not members of any subversive organizations, particularly the Osewa Brandvag. Shasta drove them out to Young's Field in the Jaguar, and as they parked behind the hangar, Blaine unfolded his long legs and climbed out of the sports car. "Well, at least the most grueling part of the journey is over with," he remarked. There was a police inspector waiting for them on the hard stand below the Roberts Heights control tower as Shasta taxied the Rapide in and cut the engines. He came forward to meet them as Blaine and Shasta came down the landing steps. "How's the investigation going?" Blaine demanded immediately after they had shaken hands. "What have you found so far?" "Nothing, Minister." The inspector shook his head. "We have checked over 600 cases of rifles. It's a time-consuming job, but so far everything seems to be in order." "How many cases in the stores?" asked Blaine.
980.
"So you have checked over half," Blaine shook his head. "Let's go and have a look, anyway." He settled his hat on his head and buttoned his overcoat to the neck, for there was a cold wind sweeping across the airstrip, bringing memories of the snows of the Drakensberg Mountains, and the high veld grass was bleached silvery by the frosts of late winter. He and Shasta climbed into the back seat of the black police Packard, and neither of them spoke on the short journey into the centre of Pretoria. At the gates to the railway workshops, there was a double guard of police and military personnel. They checked the occupants of the Packard carefully, not visibly impressed by Blaine's status. The chief inspector in charge of the investigation was in the office of the workshop manager, and his report had little to add to what they already knew. They had, so far, been unable to find any irregularity in the production of packaging of weapons. "Give me the tour," Blaine ordered grimly, and the entire party, Blaine, Shasta, the chief inspector, and the workshop manager, went out onto the main production floor. Workshop was hardly a correct description of the large factory that they entered. Originally built to service and repair the rolling stock of the state-owned railway, it had been expanded and modernized until it was capable of building its own locomotives from scratch. Now the long production line along which they picked their way was turning out armored cars for the desert war in North Africa. The working of the factory had not been halted by the police investigation, and the cavernous sheds roofed with corrugated iron echoed to the thunder of the steam presses and the cacophony of the lathes and turret-head drills. "How many men do you employ?" Blaine had to shout to make himself heard in the uproar. "Almost 3,000 altogether. We are working 3 shifts now, wartime production." The manager took them through to the furthest building. "This is where we turn out the small arms," he shouted, "or rather the metal parts, barrels and blocks. The woodwork is manufactured by outside contractors." "Show us the finished articles and the packaging," Blaine ordered. "That's where the trouble is, if there is trouble." After assembly and checking, the completed rifles, British Long Service No. 4 Mark 1 in .303 calibre, were greased and wrapped in yellow greaseproof paper, then packed in the long WD green wooden cases, 10 rifles to a case. Finally, the cases were loaded onto steel pallets and trundled through to the dispatch stores. When they entered the dispatch stores, there were a dozen uniformed police constables working with at least 50 factory employees in blue overalls. Each case was being taken down from the tall stacks and opened by one of the constables. Then the wrapped rifles were taken out and counted, repacked, and the case lids relocked. The checked cases were being stacked at the far end of the storehouse. And Chassa saw immediately that only about 50 cases remained to be opened and inspected. The chief storekeeper hurried across from his desk and challenged Blaine indignantly.
"I don't know who you are, but if you are the bloody fool who has ordered this, you need your ass kicked. We've lost a day's production. There is a goods train at the siding and a convoy waiting in Durban Harbour to take these weapons to our boys up north."
Chassa left the group and went across to watch the working constables.
"No luck?" he asked one of them.
"We're wasting our time," the man grunted without looking up.
And Chassa silently reviled himself. A day's war production lost because of him. It was a dire responsibility, and his sense of despondency increased as he stood and watched the remaining cases opened, checked and resealed. The constables assembled at the door of the stores, and the overall factory employees went out through the tall sliding doors to resume their posts on the production line. The police inspector came back to where they stood in a small, disconsolate group.
"Nothing, Minister. I'm sorry."
"We had to do it," Blaine said, glancing at Chassa. "Nobody is to blame."
"Too bloody true somebody is to blame," the chief storeman broke in truculently. "Now that you had your fun, can I get on with loading the rest of the equipment?"
Chassa stared at him. There was something about the man's behaviour that set off a little warning tingle down his spine. The blustering defensive manner, the shiftiness of his gaze.
"Of course," he thought. "If there was a switch, this is where it would take place. And this fellow would be in it to his neck."
His mind was starting to slough off the inertia of disappointment and anticlimax.
"All right," Blaine agreed. "It was a wild goose chase. You can get on with your work."
"Hold on, sir," Chassa intervened quietly, and he turned back to the storeman. "How many railway trucks have you loaded already?" There it was again, the shift of the man's eyes, the slight hesitation. He was going to lie. Then he glanced involuntarily at the sheaf of papers in the clipboard that lay on his desk beside the doors that led out onto the loading bays. Chassa crossed quickly to the desk and picked up the sheaf of loading manifests. 3 trucks have already been loaded," he read from the manifest. "Which are they?"
"They've been shunted away," the storeman muttered sulkily.
"Then let's have them shunted back here right away," Blaine intervened briskly.
Blaine and Chassa stood together under the arc lamps on the concrete loading quay, while the first of the closed railway goods trucks was unlocked and the sliding door opened. The interior of the truck was loaded to the roof with green rifle cases.
"If they are here, they will be at the bottom of the load," Chassa suggested. "Whoever is responsible would get rid of the evidence as soon as possible. He'd make damn sure they were the first cases loaded."
"Get down to the bottom cases," Blaine ordered sharply, and the top cases were carried out and stacked on the quay.
"Right," Blaine pointed to the back of the truck. "Get that case out and open it."
The lid came up, and the constable let it fall to the concrete floor with a clatter.
"Sir," he exclaimed, "look at this."
Blaine stepped up beside him and stared down into the open box. And then he looked up again quickly. The chief storekeeper was hurrying across the floor of the shed towards the doors at the far end.
"Arrest that man," Blaine shouted urgently, and 2 constables ran forward and seized him.
He was struggling angrily as they dragged him out onto the loading quay. Blaine turned to Chasseur, his expression grim and his eyes flinty. "Well, my boy, I hope you are satisfied. You've given us a mountain of work and a lot of sleepless nights ahead," he said. Fifteen grave men sat around the long, polished stinkwood table in the panelled cabinet office and listened silently as Blaine Malcolmus made his report. "There is no way of establishing with any certainty exactly how many weapons are missing. Two other large shipments have been sent out since the first of the month, and as yet neither of these has reached its destination in Cairo. They are still in transit. But we must expect that weapons are missing from both shipments. I estimate that some 2,000 rifles, together with 1.5 million rounds of ammunition." The men around the table stirred uneasily, but nobody spoke. "This is alarming, of course. However, the truly disturbing aspect of the business is the theft of some 30 to 50 Vickers machine guns from the same source."
"This is incredible," Denise Wright muttered. "That is enough to launch a nationwide rebellion. It could be 1914 all over again."
"We must make sure no word of this gets out. It will cause panic." "We should also consider," Blaine went on, "the tons of explosives hijacked in the Karoo. These would almost certainly be used to disrupt communications and prevent deployment of our limited military strength. If there was to be a rebellion..." "Please tell us, Blaine," the Prime Minister held up a finger. "Firstly, do we have any indication of when we can expect them to come out into the open and attempt their coup d'etat?"
"No, Prime Minister. The best I can do is an estimate based on our probable discovery of the weapons theft. They must have realized that the theft would be discovered as soon as the first consignment reached Cairo, and almost certainly they plan to move before that time."
"When would the shipment have reached Cairo?" asked the Prime Minister. 2 weeks
from now, approximately."
"So, we must expect they will make the attempt within days, rather than weeks."
"I'm afraid so, Prime Minister."
"My next question, Blaine. How complete is your investigation? Do you have a full list of the ringleaders of the OB and the Sturmjägers?"
"Not a full list. We have only about 600 names so far. I think it includes almost all their key men, but of course we can't have any way of being sure about that."
"Thank you, Blaine."
The Prime Minister tugged thoughtfully at his small silver goatee beard. His expression was almost serene, his blue eyes calm and unworried. They all waited for him to speak again.
"How sensitive are the names on the list?" he asked.
"There is the administrator of the Orange Free State."
"Yes, we know about him."
12 members of Parliament, including one former cabinet minister."
"Parliamentary privilege," Field Marshal Smuts muttered. "We can't touch them."
"Then there are church leaders, at least 4 high-ranking army officers, top civil servants, 1 assistant police commissioner."
Blaine read the list through, and by the time he had finished, the Prime Minister had already made up his mind.
"We can't afford to wait," he said. "With the exception of the members of Parliament, I want detention and internment orders prepared for all the others on the list of suspects. I'll sign them as soon as they are drafted. In the meantime, I want you to plan the simultaneous arrests of all of them and make provision for their incarceration."
"There are the concentration camps built for Italian prisoners of war at Bavianspoort and Pietermaritzburg," Blaine pointed out.
"Good," Field Marshal Smuts agreed. "I want these men all safely behind barbed wire as soon as possible. And I want the missing weapons and explosives found, and found quickly."
"We cannot afford to wait," Manfred de la Rey said carefully. "Every hour is dangerous. Every day brings us closer to the brink. A week could spell disaster." "We are not ready. We need time," one of the other men in the first-class railway compartment cut in. There were 8 men, including Manfred, in the compartment. They had boarded the southbound express separately at different stops over the last 200 miles. The conductor of the train was a sympathizer, and there were Sturmjägers in the corridors outside the compartment, acting as sentries. Nobody could reach them or eavesdrop on their conversation. "You promised us another 10 days in which to complete the final preparations." "We haven't got 10 days, man. Haven't you listened to what I'm telling you?" "It can't be done," the man repeated stubbornly. "It can be done," Manfred raised his voice. "It has to be done." The administrator intervened sternly. "Enough of that, gentlemen. Let's keep the fighting for our enemies